Well, if you have some questions about the stars or about meteor showers or about optics, binoculars, or telescopes to watch the stars, we have got the show for you here. Jim Lattice, director of the UW-Madison Space Place, and Tom Hall, optics specialist with Eagle Optics of Middleton, Wisconsin, back again to talk astronomy, and really pleased to have them along. And certainly, if you have questions for them, give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd love to hear from you. Jim Lattice, welcome back. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
Tom Hall, thank you for coming by.
Always nice to join you, Larry.
Lots of things going on, and one of the things I did want to mention before we go to our phones right away is the morning, is it early morning hours of August 28th?
Yeah, there's the lunar eclipse.
Lunar eclipse. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's going to be a nice one. We haven't had a good total lunar eclipse. There was one in last March, but it was cloudy, as I recollect.
Yeah.
At least I didn't see it. And before that, we'd had a long spell, like I think it was over 2 years since we had had a total lunar eclipse. So this may be our chance to see one early in the, as you say, early in the morning of the 28th on that Tuesday, I think that is, right? Tuesday morning, the 28th. And the moon will actually be setting before the eclipse is over. It'll be still almost totally eclipsed when the moon sets, which happens at sunrise in the with the full moon. So we'll see the totally eclipsed moon on the western horizon setting as the sun is coming up over in the east. And that's kind of an unusual sight. In fact, I've never seen that. I don't really know what a totally eclipsed moon looks like setting or rising in daylight, in almost daylight. So I don't know whether you can see it well or what. So I'm looking forward to getting a look at that. And a lot of people have seen Venus back all the first part of last year. Venus was hanging out in our evening sky, that bright object up there for months and months. And during this month, it's passing between us and the sun and is going to emerge into the morning sky. So if you're out there looking at the lunar eclipse, looking over in the west, just before sunrise, turn around and look east, and you'll see Venus peeking up over the horizon, and it's made that transition all the way from the evening sky to the morning sky. So that could be an interesting morning.
Lots of cool things out there to look at. John in Viroqua has a question for you guys, so let's go to John. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Sure. My question is, with watching the Perseids meteor shower last weekend, I was beginning to wonder about comets, because the Perseids is a trail of a comet, and how do they continue to exist if they're constantly putting off specks and sand and dust and particles? Do they create matter, or do they pick it up on their trip?
That's a really good question, and in fact, the answer is that they don't last forever.
Okay.
They're falling apart, and they every time they pass by the sun, they lose a lot of their volatile stuff, the more gassy kind of things at warm temperatures. And the big cloud and the tail the coma and the tail of a comet that we see are all that gaseous and also gritty, sandy stuff that's escaping from the comet and ends up along the orbit of the comet, but scattered along away from the nucleus, the actual source of the material. And the nucleus gets smaller and sort of boils down, and they think gets a heavy crust on it, maybe, or sometimes they break apart and fragment, and plenty of comets have been known to just completely disintegrate and not to be seen again, except maybe by a remnant meteor swarm that we will occasionally observe. So comets are really pretty ephemeral sorts of things. They're not fixtures of the solar system in the sense that, say, the planets are.
They'll hit the occasional planet.
Yeah.
As 15 years ago or so, we had Jupiter swallowing up a good-sized one. So as Jim says, they're not permanent.
Okay, so is it more when they're getting close to the sun and other stars that they shed a lot of stuff, or is it constantly shedding as it goes in its path?
Well, the typical comet is in the deep freeze most of the time. We'll have orbits of thousands or tens of thousands of years long, and so they spend most of that time way out in the solar system, quite frozen and probably pretty well preserved for most of that time. But then they make a pass in by the sun on what's called perihelion when they're closest to the sun. And then that energy from the sun is
things warm up.
Things warm up, and they melt like an ice cube. And then they melt a little bit, and then they swing back out again. So they can only go so many passes by the sun before they fall apart.
Thanks a lot for calling, John. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Baraboo, you are next. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
Morning.
First, I'd like to make a small plug for there are 4-H astronomy projects out there. So if anybody is interested in having their kids get started in astronomy, talk to your local 4-H representative. We in Sauk County have a real nice one with lots of telescopes, and it's a great way to get started in astronomy. That was my plug. I also would love to tell you about a little thing that happened on Monday morning. It was 5 o'clock. I was on bicycling on my way into work, still out in the country, and I had a big Perseid fly right over top. Well, right over top, 60 miles up, from almost north to south, and the last about 10 degrees of its flight, it broke up. It got really, really bright, you know, minus 50 magnitude or something, and all the little fragments kept on the line, and when they burned out after, just a microsecond, it left a smoke trail in the sky, and since the sun was almost up right there, it was all lit up. And it just twisted and turned, and then poof, it was all gone. It was the neatest thing I had ever seen in a meteor.
Well, you hit the holy grail of meteor observation. That's what we all hope for.
I'm envious now.
When we get out there and look, people who have done it for years, like Jim or myself, occasionally see one that appears to go from horizon to horizon. I've only seen one that broke up, and it broke up into two pieces. So you've hit the jackpot there, and that's why we get out there.
Yeah, I've got one question for you. The peak for the Oregids, which is usually a pretty meek shower, is on September 1, and I heard rumors that it's going to be big and bright and colorful this year. What have you heard?
Well, right. What I understand is that the there are people who try to computer model those streams. This goes back to our previous caller's question, really. Every time the comet, a comet, comes around on another pass through the solar system, the orbit is typically a little bit different from the way it was before, so it leaves a different trail of debris, but they're all running along there more or less parallel. So you have these swarms with distinctions between them, sort of gaps and then concentrations of material. And there's a fellow who thinks that he's able to figure out that the Earth is going to pass through one of those dense swarms from the comet that's responsible for the Oregid shower. And so that's the reason for the prediction on the morning of September 1st. So it depends on among other things, on how good this guy's computer model is. But that's what's got us all excited. And so, yeah, that's a possibility. Now, unfortunately, the timing, unlike the Perseids, where we had the good luck this year that it fell at new moon, so we had no lunar interference, the moon will be waning gibbous, I think, on September 1st. And so we'll still have some moonlight up there, but it's probably still worth going out and looking anyway, because if we get storm-level activity out of the Oregids, then that may be a once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity. So that's what I've heard.
Thanks for calling. Jeff, appreciate your call. Doug in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I have a question, and I also have a plug. The question is, I understood that the old Washburn Observatory was starting to pick up a lot of light from the city lights around it, and you were losing the ability to see a lot of the stars, and that out at the new Pine Bluff Observatory, you can see more stars because there's less light. And I was just wondering how much light in the sky is now starting to affect the Pine Bluff Observatory. And my plug is for the International Dark Sky Association, IDA.org, if people are moving into the country and building houses and putting up dusk to dawn lights and all kinds of outdoor lighting, they can buy dark sky rated lights from any electrical contractor that'll shine the light down instead of up into the sky. They're cheaper to run. They don't light up everything, and they do their job just as well as ordinary lights. And if you want to see some examples, right out here in Mount Horeb, our village put in dark sky rated down lights on Main Street. I think they have them in Verona, too, and you can walk down the middle of Mount Horeb all lit up and look up in the sky and still see the stars.
Oh.
Yeah, those are all excellent points. You're entirely right about that it costs almost nothing extra to put in safe and environmentally high-quality lights at the beginning when you're doing it, or even to retrofit existing lights. It sometimes is pretty inexpensive to put cutoffs, and then Very often you can then use lower wattage bulbs, lower wattage, so you can save energy in the process. And the Dark Sky Association is a great great organization, and they have a lot of useful information there. So I agree with you completely. As to your question about Pine Bluff Observatory, I was actually just out there the other night and was surprised. It had been a couple of years since I had done any sky gazing out there, and the light pollution is worse than just it was a couple of years ago. The glow from the sky on the eastern side, back towards Madison, or what's now the outskirts of Madison out there, is noticeable and really, really degrades the sky, certainly from the visual standpoint. The question, I don't think you quite asked this, but there's also the question of how does it affect scientific research that goes on out there. And that's a little more complicated because then it depends on just what kind of observation they're doing, because there are types of studies that aren't so affected by ambient light. But certainly there are plenty that are affected. And what it really does is it restricts the range of possible activities at the observatory, forcing us into areas that won't be so much affected by light pollution. But it's a very serious factor out there.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, Doug. Appreciate it. Louise in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Louise. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a plug, too. It's for Spring Green's sesquicentennial. My gosh, I said it. That's 150 years. We're having a star party on September 2nd. Peter Livingston is bringing a couple of good telescopes and even a solar telescope. And people are invited to come and look at the dark sky thanks to Alliant Energy turning off the lights in North Park.
Cool.
In fact, I'm going to be there.
Yes. Great. I thought that was you. Yeah, we're all very excited about having you.
I'm looking forward to being out there. We tried that, was that last year, and got rained out.
Yes, we did it at the high school last year.
Yeah.
But people are very enthusiastic, and we're looking forward to maybe seeing some of that meteor shower left over on Sunday night.
Well, you can only hope.
Hope for the best.
Hope for the best. Thanks a lot, Louise, for calling. By the way, the previous caller asked about the Washburn Observatory as well. We should probably... You want to comment on the Washburn?
Yeah, of course. Washburn Observatory, right up on the university campus. Tom's been there
many times.
Yeah. The observatory is since 1881 has been open to the public on the first and third Wednesday nights of the month, if the sky is clear. And during the summer, so now rapidly dwindling, but during the summer, June, July, and August, every Wednesday night, weather permitting. And so that's an important opportunity, I think, for people to come have an experience, an astronomical experience and a historical experience. That's a very fine telescope. You'll rarely look through, at least in my experience, rarely look through an optically better telescope than that instrument up there.
And Tom, you've been out there many a time too?
They generally go for brighter objects, like the previous caller was worried about the light pollution for it, but Saturn through that telescope it will knock your socks off. It is a truly fine instrument, as Jim says. And they're going to be going through some refurbishment here in the near future.
Right. The plans are not yet entirely set for that, but the intention is to renovate that building over the next couple of years. But we don't know the schedule just yet for how that will be going. But people should watch for a schedule, and you should certainly hasten over there, because it may be that access to the telescope will be restricted for a while there while there's work on the building.
It's a neat looking building.
And then you were going to take over some observing duties at UW Space Place to make sure that the programs can continue through that.
Yeah, we're not certain about that, but I think I'm hoping that we're going to pick up some extra observing nights at Space Place to make up for the ones we're going to lose at Washburn. So we'll make announcements about that when we have all the details worked out.
Thanks, Louise. Appreciate it. Tom and Stoddard, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I wanted to mention that in about 1960, I was able to observe a total eclipse that was a setting moon, and it was really interesting that it had changed finally to all brown. And then as it neared the moonset, it turned a nice orange and finally red. It was very impressive.
Oh.
I look forward to that.
Thank you very much for sharing that. I appreciate that. So that's maybe, hopefully, what we can look forward to seeing.
It's surely going to depend on, exact atmospheric conditions and things like that, as lunar eclipses always do. But it could be really unusual.
Again, that's the early morning hours of Tuesday, August 28th for the lunar eclipse.
Correct. Yeah, the eclipse actually starts Well, the part you probably want to go out to see starts around 3:50 a.m. So it actually starts even earlier than that, but not very easily observable. And then totality begins at about 4:52 in the morning, so not quite 5 o'clock. And then the middle of the eclipse is at 5:37. And I believe sunset is, let's see, I've got sunset time here. The sunrise, excuse me. Sunrise is at about 6:17. So you're only about a half an hour away from sunrise by the middle of the eclipse. And okay. The sky is going to start to get bright and that sort of thing in that time window. So you want to get out there and get a look at the moon probably. Better get out there by 5.
Out there by 5.
And then watch for a while.
All right. Thanks again, Tom, for calling. Jim Lannis, director of the UW-Madison Space Place. One of our guests, the other, Tom Hall of Eagle Optics. Glad to have them along. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking optics and astronomy today. I guess they kind of go together with Jim Lattice of the UW Space Place, Tom Hall of Eagle Optics. Jim, I know you wanted to add something to our...
Just to the lunar eclipse discussion, we will be having a program at Space Place. We figure anybody can go out and observe the lunar eclipse in their backyard, but on Saturday morning, the 25th, at 10 a.m., we'll have one of our family workshops. It'll be devoted to the topic of lunar eclipses, so you might want to bring the family over there to learn about then what we're going to see on the morning of the 28th. So that's at Space Place, at UW Space Place, 2300 South Park, at 10 a.m. on August 25th, Saturday.
And again, we've had a few people call in and say, oh, I didn't get the date again for the eclipse itself, and that's the 28th.
Early morning of the 28th, right? Not the evening of the 28th, early morning of the 28th. So.
All right. We've got Eric, I believe, and then Harry. Let's go to Eric in Cashton next. Hi, Eric.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have spent a good bit of time on the internet for work and stuff, and I've come across quite a bit of information on a 10th planet in our solar system called Nibiru, sometimes referred to as Planet X, and supposedly has like a 3,400-year rotation around our sun, and it's currently on its way back around the sun, and I was just wondering if your guests know anything about it. The planet supposedly is about the size of Jupiter, and I was just wondering if they know anything about it and what the effect that planet would have re-entering the solar system with our own gravitational pull, our own rotation around the sun, anything like that.
Well, the first thing to say is that there's no actual evidence for the existence of that object. There are a lot of theories about you can make up a theory when you have the freedom to choose the mass of the object and the periodicity of the orbit and the inclination of the orbit and all those things. You can make theories fit an awful lot of scenarios, but there's no actual evidence for the existence of that object. So what you're finding out there are people's attempts to explain one thing or another by invoking a planet for which there's no evidence. Nobody's ever seen it. Nobody's ever actually, you know, gotten light from it or anything along that line. If a large planet did pass through the solar system, then certainly it could affect the planets if it underwent a close encounter with one planet or the other. And again, Tom gave the example of comets. We see that all the time when comets have close encounters with planets, it changes their orbits, and sometimes the comets even collide with Jupiter. So choose your parameters there, and you can make any scenario come out that you want. But there's no evidence for that actual existence of that object.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Eric. Harry in Rice Lake, it's your turn. By the way, if you'd like to join in, give us a call. We have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty fast at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Harry in Rice Lake, hello to you. Morning.
I would like to hear your comments regarding digital optics and image stabilization regarding telescopes and binoculars. I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Digital optics. Tom Hall?
Boy, that's a pretty open-ended question in some respects, I guess. They've done digital imaging through telescopes for a number of years, and they've had specialty cameras that you can put on in place of eyepieces to take some really fine digital photographs of the night sky. They have some pluses over film photography. they'll operate much faster. You can track an object for a shorter span of time and introduce fewer mechanical problems, so you get a better image sometimes just using the digital imaging. There are some digital cameras that fit to spotting scopes these days that you can use for astronomy, and that is something that's kind of new in that you can use it as an eyepiece visually and take an image of what you're looking at. That's kind of unusual. COA Instruments has one that's fairly recent. It's only been out a few months. Looks like an intriguing possibility. And that is something where you can be using the instrument and then take images right at the same time. Image stabilization, that's a very good question. Most of the image-stabilized binoculars, and Jim has looked at a few of these that we've tried to bring out and demonstrate, most of the image-stabilized binoculars are kind of adapted from marine use. They'll use them on boats to take out the vibration of hands or natural hand tremor as we age, any of those sorts of things. Fujinon makes several varieties of those. Nikon has some. Canon makes some excellent ones. The downside to some of those image-stabilized binoculars is they're not typically in the realm of what we like to use for astronomy, in that they'll not have a large enough front aperture with their high magnification to deliver a large exit pupil. In other words, to match with your dilated eye that you have out at night. You're essentially using what would be a daytime binocular, and you might not get as good an image of the dim extents of objects that you'd like to use. Having said that, some people really swear by them and like to use them on brighter objects at night. The Canon image stabilized binoculars, you can get some that would be a 10 by 30, for instance, a 10 power binocular that some people can't hand hold, but they'll really take all the shake out of your hands and you can see a star field quite well. Yeah. But it's only a 30 millimeter front objective, so you won't be doing a whole lot of bright, you know, viewing with something like that. Those you can get for around $400. They have some that are past $1,000, where you can get a 10 by 50. That's the highest ratio of exit pupil and light gathering that I think is currently out on the market. They make some that are 15 by 50, and that's very high-powered, really, something you'd normally use only on a tripod. So there are some possibilities out there for those. Stick to the brighter objects. But you can get non-stabilized binoculars and do some tricks with those to try to get some of that same effect. They can be expensive. They do the job of what they're advertised to do, but you can't go for the galaxies or some of the Messier objects, the things we'd traditionally call deep sky objects. Those can be tougher with the image-stabilized equipment.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Darlington, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Larry. Good morning to you and your people that work in astronomy.
Go ahead.
And when I worked in the pharmacy school in the 1970s and 80s, in the physics astronomy building.
Uh-huh.
And when the Wisconsin people, the astronomers, were working with the Hubble telescope, they did some work with that. Mm-hmm. And they used to ask me for a special small pharmaceutical tools and things and special glassware, and I used to provide them with that. And then every time these two or three professors would get in, an astronomical event would take place where I could, then they would ask, they'd call me up, I'd be the first one to be called, and then to look at the event on their special telescope. So I felt privileged with that.
Great.
Well, that's great. And so that research was done here.
Right. I suppose we're talking about the construction of the high-speed photometer, which was the one of the five original science instruments on the Hubble Space Telescope. It's been removed long ago as they've updated the instruments on the telescope. But we built that right there in, not quite, actually. It was actually built over one building over, but the project was headquartered out of Chamberlain and Stirling Halls there. And so I suppose that's what you're talking about. We still have a lot of involvement with the Hubble Space Telescope in that our astronomers use it constantly for observations. It's operated like a national observatory. You can propose, anybody really can propose, to make an observation with the Hubble Space Telescope, and it gets evaluated. And if the proposal is approved, then you get time, and they do the observation and send you the data. You get it over the internet, so you don't ever have to leave Madison or anything along that line. So we still have a lot of involvement with the Hubble at that sort of level, not so much at the building instruments for it anymore.
What about the status of the Hubble? Are we in? Where are we on that?
Well, it's operational, and they have you know the sort of constant technical problems here and there that take one instrument out or another. I haven't actually checked to see what the status of the instruments is currently. But it badly needs that servicing mission
that's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, and the servicing mission is on, last I heard. So,
that's what I've heard also. They have one more mission at least to do some servicing on the Hubble.
Yeah, and so then that should extend the life of it on out, well, you know, with any luck, another 2-3 years at least, and hopefully a few more. But after that, it's going to be done.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Bob. I appreciate it. Gene in Wales will give you a chance now. Hi, Gene.
Good morning.
Morning.
What was suggested is one possible way to get rid of nuclear waste would be to put on a rocket and send it to the sun. So I guess in your domain of expertise, one or two scenarios. What's the downside to launching, you know, nuclear waste to the sun? What happens if we miss the sun and it keeps on going? And then what happens if it's in a suborbital flight and then it comes crashing down to Earth?
Well,
Jim, you want to take that?
Certainly that would be a good place to send nuclear waste is into the sun. But, you know, what does it cost us now? $100 per pound to get something just into orbit?
The lift weight ratio would be a little prohibitive, unfortunately.
To send our garbage into space. But it would cost a lot more than that because it's not just putting it into orbit. It's a matter of then getting it out of Earth orbit so that it drops into the sun. You don't just put something out there and falls in. You actually have to slow it down from the Earth's orbital speed so that it will fall into the sun. So the cost would be high even if everything worked really well. But then, as you point out, things don't always work exactly the way we plan, right? And so, right, if one of those launches fails and it doesn't reach orbit and falls back onto the Earth, I'm no expert on what would happen if radioactive waste got loose around at the site of a rocket crash, but it probably wouldn't be a good thing. As far as missing the sun, and then if you're getting ready to deorbit that thing to fall into the sun, and something goes wrong with that rocket firing, and it just goes into an orbit, it'd be, in that case, a little bit like a comet's orbit that has a perihelion somewhere closer to the sun, and then would come out at aphelion back out to Earth's orbit. And so then it would keep on passing by the Earth's orbit, and at some point, after a number of revolutions, should make a close pass by the Earth, so we might see that thing again if it actually intersects with the Earth. So there would be all kinds of things to deal with on that sort of plan. I suspect that it's just too expensive to even consider.
Thanks, Gene, for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm interested in buying a 6-inch refractor, Meade's LXD75. I noticed it's relatively inexpensive, $1,200. And most refractors of that size cost thousands more. It got a really good review in Astronomy Magazine, but I'm wondering if it's all they're saying it is.
I've had some experience with the larger refractors, both from Celestron and from Meade, who are the two larger commercial instrument manufacturers, if you will, here in this country. And they can be very nice instruments. The 6-inch refractors, 150 millimeters, will generally have a shorter focal length. And if I'm recalling that one correctly, the focal length is around F5?
The focal ratio is F8
for the focal ratio on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have a fairly good-sized vehicle?
Yes, I do, actually.
There you go. And you've already considered that, because you'll have a pretty large tube.
Yes, I know.
To cart this thing around.
Yeah,
it's probably pretty
inches.
Heavy, too. It must need a good mount.
Yeah, they have a good mount for those, actually, from what I've used on those. I'll recommend those very highly, quite frankly, so long as you don't, you know, worry about transporting them. The advantage to that really long, I am not familiar with that one, with that long of the focal ratio, so that corrects a lot of somewhat inherent problems in a refractor. That's what they're trying to do by giving it that long focal ratio. You'll have better color correction and, you know, generally get a sharper image out of them. So for that kind of money, you bet. You're getting a lot of bang for your buck. You don't have a central obstruction like you would have in the Newtonian scopes. They're ideal for planetary observation. So Jupiter and Saturn through a 6-inch refractor can look, you know, just wonderful. Mm-hmm. So you bet, depending on what you'd like to do with them, and, you know, if you don't mind transporting them out to dark skies and having that vehicle that's going to, you know, have a lot of telescope taking up most of the room.
Well, what are we giving up, though, over, like, the Teleview or the astrophysics or something instruments in that class?
The Televiews are excellent, and the largest he's traditionally made, and only in very limited production, was a 5-inch.
Okay.
He did 125. Most of his cluster around the 4-inch range, 102 millimeters.
Okay,
Astrophysics makes some very large refractors that are excellent, but, boy, nowhere near that price range.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm wondering is what are we giving up there to get that to that price?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, you'll have some color correction that they can get into by the time you start throwing money at the front objective, and that's what you're doing. You're essentially paying for higher density glasses and doublets and triplets for the front objective that are most of the cost of the telescope.
Okay.
The astrophysics instruments are superb. I got a chance to look through one of their 6-inchers from a gentleman down in Illinois that had it set up in his own private observatory out in the country.
Wow.
So he had dark skies. He didn't have to transport it. So that's why the big tube can be a problem. You will want to try to use them out in dark skies because they're fun instruments to get out and, you know, push the limits with.
Yeah. So good luck. Thanks very much for calling, Kathy. Appreciate it. You know, we've still got time to go here in the show, but I do want to mention the websites that you both have, Eagle Optics. Where do we go for the Eagle Optics website?
Well, that's an easy one, eagleoptics.com.
EagleOptics.com. And UW Space Place has got a nice website as well.
Yeah, the easiest one is spaceplace.org.
Spaceplace.org. And all the events and everything that's happening are on spaceplace.org.
Certainly, yeah. You can find out about our events, and you can also download a copy of our, in this case, the August flyer that we put out, which we call Eyes on the Skies. We update that every month. But if you get the August one now, it's got a little feature in there about the upcoming lunar eclipse with all the times and details, along with other things as well. So you can download that as a PDF from that website and find out about all our events.
Okay. Wanted to get that in before the end here. Glenn in Cambridge, it's your turn. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. We're going to be traveling in Alaska the last week of August, first week of September. We're going to be in Fairbanks the 28th to the 30th. I read on the Internet that there's going to be a high activity for Aurora Borealis, and I'm curious whether we're going to have an opportunity to see that with a full moon.
Oh, you certainly can still see it, even with full moon, because it is quite bright up there. It's a Japanese tourist destination just for that reason, from what I've heard. So you might not get some of the best effect. Hopefully you can kind of get it to, you know, your back. Keep looking north, and, you know, the moon will be a little further down in your southern hemisphere for you. But no, I've heard it's so bright up there and such a terrific show that I wouldn't worry about it from that aspect. I'd just go up and enjoy it.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Glenn. Good luck on the trip.
That's on my list of some things I have to go do before the end of my days. Go see the Aurora Borealis up in Alaska because I hear it is superb.
Well, let's do that.
Mike in Rice Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Great show. The wife and I just took an impromptu vacation over the weekend and ended up in the Porcupine Mountains just when the Persides were coming through. And talk about it. Oh, man, that was wonderful. But my question is, there was a ranger show that night, and he had an 8-inch telescope. And actually, I was the first time I'd ever looked through a telescope of that size, and actually I was pretty disappointed what we could see even looking at Jupiter. It just looked like a huge, like, flashlight pretty much in the sky, although we could see the rings on edge a little bit. But what kind of telescope size do you actually need, you know, where you could, like, actually, like, maybe see the spot on Jupiter or something like that, you know?
What size did you say it was?
It was an 8-inch, I think.
So a new, are we talking about Newtonian here?
It was, I think it was the Schmidt-Cassegrain, I think he said it was. I'm not sure, you know. It was.
Okay. Tom, what about it?
Well, he brings up a good point, and that is something that we always try to talk or warn people almost about in looking through a telescope. You don't see color. You know, people get the long exposure photographs from the Hubble telescope, and they get excited about hopefully seeing some of these objects up in the sky. But with our perception at night, where we don't have enough light coming in, even through a good-sized telescope, to show much color. So a lot of what you can look at is black and white. The planets through an 8-inch Schmidt should actually be pretty good, although sometimes that takes a bit of practice and a few observation sessions to really pick out some of the fine points.
Certainly it can depend on atmospheric conditions.
Oh, definitely. And in the summer, we don't get the best atmospheric conditions sometimes.
So turbulence can cause what might be clear details on the surface of the planet to just become sort of mudges that you don't really distinguish very well at all.
The great red spot, good point to your question there, is kind of the dim orange spot these days. It does have periods, and it has been kind of waning for some time. It is a storm within Jupiter's gas shell, and it has the features of most storms. So these days it's not that easy to pick out, and it has to be facing the correct direction. So there's a certain time period in looking through it where you won't be picking it up.
Right, it would have to be on the hemisphere facing you. And we're also, everything we've said is assuming that the telescope is in optimal condition, which may or may not be the case with a Schmidt-Cassegrain.
You should have seen banding at least on the gas cloud surface of the planet. Did you catch any hints of the bands?
Yeah, the ranger pointed out there, you could see almost like a grayish brown smudge, you know, which he said was the rings.
There you go. But yeah, in a smaller telescope, the apparent size of Jupiter isn't even going to be quite as good as what he was bringing up for you. So to some of us, it's just the joy of being able to pick out those objects. Saturn, with its rings, always does, you know, give a good show for people that, you know, there's something they can really look at and appreciate. For Jupiter, for me, one thing that was always a nice feature to look for was one of the moons passing in front of the planet. Now, there is a feature that you can easily see with an 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain,
yeah,
and that's
the shadow
of the moon.
We saw four moons, actually. So
if they're spread out to the side there, you can pick out the Jupiter's moons.
The
when one passes in front, you can actually see the black dot of the shadow cast on the planet. You know, that's neat little features that you can look for.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
You bet. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. And Tom and Jim, thank you so much for coming by. Really appreciate the time flew.
Thank you, Larry.
It does always, it seems. Thank you, Larry.
We'll have you both back. And again, if you want to take a look at the websites, go to spaceplace.org, spaceplace.org. Or if you want to be interested in some optics as well, go to eagleoptics.com, eagleoptics.com. Jim Lattice of the Space Place, Tom Hall of Eagle Optics, our guest. And we really appreciate having them along. And they'll be back again, and we will talk with them some more. Coming up, we're going to be talking about sun-related skin problems and maybe zero in a little bit on problems relating to seniors. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.